You're listening to the Exploring Research Careers podcast, the podcast that talks to people about their research careers and also explores personal histories of those who support researchers. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Margaret Collins, now Director of Training for Universities, which provides training and coaching for researchers and academics on everything from project management to more practical things like how to write an abstract. While we discuss the many twists and turns of Dr. Collins' career, we'll also have a specific focus on imposter syndrome, where we'll discuss Dr. Collins' book, Beyond Imposter Syndrome. We'll also look at sources and solutions to help us cope with the phenomenon. So you're very welcome to our podcast this episode. I'm joined by Dr. Margaret Collins, who is from a company called Training for Universities. Margaret trained as an immunologist, and she's going to talk to us about her background in research as a postdoc, as an academic, and how she transitioned into a different sector and a different career. And then we're going to focus on imposter syndrome. Margaret has written a book specifically on that topic, and I know it's a topic that affects a lot of people at the moment. So we're going to kind of dive into that in a little bit more detail later on. Margaret, you're so welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking me, Linda. It was a delight to get your invitation.
Great. So we're going to kick off with the kind of questions about maybe your background and your journey. My first question is, what led you to do a PhD? How did that all happen?
For me, doing a PhD was quite a surprise. I, as a child, came from a very non-academic family, and neither of my parents had any qualifications whatsoever, but they were very supportive of me at school. And I am the eldest of six children, so I was the first going through school. I went to a school that only went up to the level where we would do O-levels or GCSEs. It had no sixth form college. And I did well in my exams and was supported by my parents, and we decided that I'd do my A-levels. So I had to go to a different school, and I went to a sixth form college. Once I got there, obviously, a very much more academic environment, all my peers were considering applying to university. And if I'm completely honest, I didn't really know what a university was. You know, I loved learning. I loved school. I knew I liked what I did. But what was this? The only thing I knew about universities was seeing University Challenge on telly. But everybody else was doing this, so I just sort of went through the process. And yes, I put in my application to go to university. I even went on some interviews, and it was all a bit exciting, but watching University Challenge doesn't really prepare you for doing an undergraduate degree at university. It was quite an adventure. And even when I got there, I discovered that I absolutely loved and it was a microbiology that I was doing at the time. I did a degree in cell and immunobiology, and I loved the molecular genetics aspect of this, the how does it work. And that's why I then went on to do a PhD. So I was the first person in my family to do A-levels, the first to go to university, the first to do a PhD. And it was simply pursuing my love of learning.
Was there ever a thought process or a pause between your degree and your PhD? Did you ever stop at that point and go, I'm going to do this because this is going to give me this qualification or this choice or this pathway?
What a really interesting question. And the answer was no, because at the time, I didn't know people who took a break between doing their bachelor's and their PhD. Everybody that I was aware of had gone from one to the other. So, you know, that wasn't in my expectations. In terms of doing other jobs that might have been available, in all honesty, when I consider the jobs that might have been available to me, my background in education told me that the one that most of my peers did was marry someone and have kids. I knew I didn't want that. Or they went and worked in a supermarket or a factory. You know, I didn't want that. So what else did you do once you had a degree? Well, of course, you went on to do a PhD, didn't you? Now, of course, looking back, I know that that's absolutely not the truth. But in terms of my experience at the time, I really didn't know what some of the other options were. I was also delighted. I really was passionately interested in how does it work? How does something as small as a bacterium or a virus kill something as big as you or me? And therefore, it was a delight to be able to go on and do that PhD.
I think that's one of the challenges that we experience even now, or one of the questions. Just this week, we had a PhD event and people don't seem to ask that question, what am I going to do with my PhD? What's it going to provide me with in the sense of a career or an opportunity? A lot of people were kind of surprised that we emphasized that so much.
Absolutely. Now, having had my own academic career, I was working within a research environment for many, many years. And I can see that post-PhD life is much more competitive than it was when I was doing my postdocs. And I can also see that doing the PhD would have suited me for many other options that I was completely unaware of when I was, in my early 20s. But now I would really talk to people who've got undergraduate degrees or master's degrees and ask them, what is it they want from the PhD? Because unless you are absolutely committed to that research career, which is quite a bizarre career path, it's a lot of hard work, and there would be many other ways that you could get good jobs or good careers.
Was it a given expectation for you that you'd get a postdoc? Like, was that something that you thought, okay, I can see around me now the expectation is I've done my PhD, I'll get a postdoc for a couple of years. Did you think 2 years, 3 years, or did that just happen? Or what was going on at that time?
Well, during my PhD, I was encouraged to apply for a Royal Society European Fellowship. And I did that halfway through my PhD and was a successful applicant. So I knew I had that postdoc fellowship to go to for my first postdoc. But the truth is that although people weren't giving away jobs for nothing, there was competition, that there was never any serious doubt that I would be able to get a postdoc. I might not know exactly what subject, I might not know where it was, because yes, there was a lot of moving around the country. And I worked in France, and I worked in, half a dozen different universities and research institutes in the UK. But it never occurred to me that I wouldn't find a job in research, because there was always a job in research. I think that's very different today.
Yeah. At that point, in terms of those positions, I'm curious about the funding that would have been available at those times as well. Was that equally expected, or was that as challenging as it seems to be now? Or how did that all seem at the time?
At the time, again, it was competitive, but it was achievable. I didn't have any sense that it wouldn't be possible. It was just a case of when and where. I also, for the first part of my career, for the first 10 or 15 years, deliberately chose to work in research institutes rather than universities. I had one postdoc in a university and then chose research institutes because the research institutes were funded by the research councils, and therefore the funding was secure. Any grants I applied for were in addition to the core funding that I got as being a member of staff. And so, again, that took a lot of pressure off. It also meant that I didn't have any teaching responsibilities. Yes, I would supervise, PhD students, but I didn't have any teaching responsibilities, which for me was a great boon. It meant that I could, spend those first 10 or 15 years really as a dedicated researcher building up my publication record and my research profile.
When you look at academics today and you see the breadth of work they have to do, the publishing, the funding, the chasing, the temporary contracts, the teaching, what do you see, and what's your response to those people?
That it's 10 times harder today than it was when I started. And I think many of them are aware that it's tough, but I suspect that many of them aren't aware of quite how tough it is and how competitive and cutthroat it can be post-PhD. I certainly am aware that I did become a lecturer. And as soon as I became a lecturer, I, you know, had the teaching load, and I didn't have a particularly high teaching load, but it still took a lot of my time because, you know, if I'm going to teach, I'm going to do it well. And then you had the marking. It really came as quite a surprise to me after I delivered my first lecture series that I then had to devise an exam question and mark 200 exam scripts. It taught me a lot about designing good exam questions. But, you know, equally, it is very easy for you to consider that as a professional academic, you generally have your research, you have your teaching, and then you have a professional contribution to make to the university, whether that's, you know, if you're a vet or a medic, it might be a clinical contribution. If you're neither of those, then it will be committees and support work for the university. And so if you're lucky, you'll get, you know, 33% of your time devoted to each. But many people find that doing teaching takes far more than the allotted 33% of their time, effort, and energy. And it is a huge struggle for most people that I see to actually still invest in sustaining an active research career in the competitive environment that today is.
What happened then, Margaret, you know, for your own self in terms of your career? You spent many years postdocing, you secured funding. What was happening then in your mind? Were you thinking, this isn't really what I signed up for? Or how did the ripple start to begin about this is maybe not the pathway for me?
Actually, it didn't happen like that at all at first, because I so wanted to be that career researcher. And I became a lecturer, and I became a senior lecturer, and I started building up my own research team of PhD students and postdocs. Depending on how successful we were with grant writing, the research team would consist of either, you know, I think at its lowest it was about 6 people. At its largest it was about 20 people that we were supporting, or maybe they were supporting us.
How many years were you researching at that point that you had a team of 20 people?
15 to 20 years. So that would have been in the 1990s, mid-90s. Yeah. So it takes time to build up to that. Absolutely takes time to build up to that. And I will equally honestly say that I really think that getting grant funding is a lot about persistence and equally about luck. You know, it's not simply the people who are the most dedicated who get the most grant funding. There is skill to it, and there is a little bit of luck to it. So, you know, I was both skilled and lucky, and I acknowledge that. But once I became a senior lecturer and had much more responsibility for managing that research team that was growing, I realized that I didn't have the management skills for it. Training within the universities was actually rare, if not non-existent at the time. And so looking around for my own resources, I decided to train as a coach, because I decided that coaching skills would be a very useful skill set for managing my research team. And I funded that for myself. I did it part-time whilst I was, you know, full-time employed as a senior lecturer. I loved the training, and I really used the coaching skills. So that was of benefit for me. It never occurred to me that I would do anything other than be that senior lecturer managing that research team. That was all I intended to do. You ask, or two things come to my mind in response to the questions that you posed to get me here. And one is that I was the senior lecturer. It never occurred to me really that I would seriously want to be a professor. Now, not that I didn't deserve it, but I looked up the career ladder to the professors who were around me. And with one exception, they were male. I only knew one female professor at the time. And they had punishing workloads and punishing schedules. You know, I can remember regularly receiving emails into my email account at 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, I don't know whether the people who sent them stayed up late or got up early. But, you know, you could see that the expectation at that time was that a professor was someone who had work but no life balance. And that wasn't a life I wanted. And so much as I might have thought it was unfair, I couldn't quite put a finger on what was at the root of that, but I didn't want that lifestyle. And so I was content with the thought that, you know, if senior lecturer was where I got, then that was where I would stay, so long as I could keep my research grants coming in.
Was that quite different to what you were experiencing at that stage in your career as a senior lecturer? You know, was there a big difference in the dedication you were showing versus the dedication or the workload that they had?
I would say that I definitely had a life. I, you know, had a partner that I came home to every day, and that I was very happy. And yes, I did work evenings and I did take some work home with me. But I guess I'd learned much earlier in my career as a postdoc that burning the midnight oil, working 12 and 14 hour days, working weekends, was actually really damaging to my relationship. And that was enough of a shock for me to make sure that I actually prioritized and valued my relationship, and I wasn't going to sacrifice it to work.
Sure. And the reason I ask is because a lot of the people that I come in contact with, they're not even senior lecturers. They might be just, you know, 5 years at post PhD, and they seem to work. You know, you mentioned the word punishing, and that's the way it looks to me. And I think for people outside of academia, they would be amazed at what is required to even to get to that stage now. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seems constant work.
I would agree, Linda. And whilst that was what happened to me at the early stage of my career, there came to a point where I recognized it and learned how to put it into balance. And so it really, I made real choices about what I would do and what I wouldn't do for my work quite consciously, and decided that I could have both a successful career and a successful relationship.
Yeah, no, I suppose the reason I'm highlighting it is because I've spoken with, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years, so many academics, and, you know, they do have ambition and they really aspire to get on in academia. And yet when you speak to them, they're not happy. They know they're working a lot. They know that it's probably only going to get worse. They do wonder, how am I going to have a relationship? How if I find someone, how are we going to end up being together? Because there's so many pulls. And I think, you know, sometimes I ask people, are you happy? And there's a pause, you know. So I think it's kind of worthwhile just highlighting that.
Yeah, I see that too with postdocs. And I think that it is tougher now than when I was doing it. But for me, training as a coach helped me to set the boundaries, helped me to get much more effective at working. It taught me habits of working that allowed me to be productive without working 12 and 14 hour days. And it absolutely helped me to see the value in my relationship and to prioritize that. One of the things I notice now is that people are often checking emails on their smartphones at weekends or at evenings. And they might only be there for a few minutes, but those few minutes can actually stop you being present in the moment with the person that you're with. It can stop you being present in the moment with the family that you're a part of, with the community that you're socializing with. And that is really damaging in ways that I suspect many people don't appreciate. And so it is about learning to say no. It is about learning that the world will not die and you will not lose your research funding because you don't answer emails at 8 o'clock at night. The most important thing is I learned that I had value, and that I could give myself permission to value myself, and I could give myself permission to value my relationship. I suspect that many people don't have that feeling nowadays, that the only thing that they're chasing is the value of work. Once I did that, there are a variety of skills that you have in order to be able to have conversations that set boundaries, to be able to say simply and respectfully and very definitely, thank you very much for the opportunity, but that is not a priority for me at the moment.
So it helped you articulate. It kind of gave you a language.
Yeah,
okay.
It did. And subsequently, I have done further coach training, you know, over the last, I first trained as a coach 20 years ago, And I've done additional coach training since. And the skills that I have now are even more well-developed. I'm more conscious of them. And that's what I would teach my clients. Now, many of my clients are researchers and academics, and I help them to articulate how they set boundaries, which I hope gives them a much happier work-life balance.
So when a client comes to you and they want to engage in your services, that's the angle that they're looking for, rather than help me be a better academic. It's kind of help me cope with academia in a more effective way. Is that correct?
Clients are very diverse, and they come with all sorts of different things. Often I discover that the presenting problem isn't really the problem that we need to solve. And so I have clients who come to me because they are maybe at a lecturer or senior lecturer stage, but they don't feel that they are really respected by their peers. They don't, you know, they feel a very much a junior partner in collaboration. So they want to come, you know, how do I step up? How do I be, you know, more assertive and more preeminent in my field? They might come to me because they are part of senior management teams, but don't feel that their voice is heard or respected. They might come to me because they are juggling this enormous workload and realize that their relationship is going down the pan, and what do they do with it? And so the problems might be diverse, but the solutions are often surprisingly similar, because you have to first accept that you are worthy and of value. You then have to learn the skills to communicate that respectfully to others, but knowing firmly what your boundaries are.
So you're working as a coach, or you're training as a coach, and at that point then, what's happening about transitioning into another sector or moving or?
Well, at that time, I'm not really working as a coach. Only a tiny little bit, because I'm mostly still being that senior lecturer. I did register as self-employed because in order to keep the skills at their best, I was working with a small number of coaching clients. And being honest, I decided that I would declare this to the taxman. I registered as self-employed, even though I was only, you know, working with two clients a month, maybe. And then I got investigated by HMRC in the UK, Her Majesty's Customs and Revenue, because they couldn't believe that a business was a real business and wasn't making that much money. So, you know, I had to pay my accountant in order to sort out a potential case of HMRC fraud, because I wasn't working very much. But, you know, that with hindsight just makes me smile. I was this committed academic until my mother died when I was around the age of 40. And my mother died quite suddenly of cancer. Now, this was significant for me because my parents were caring for my youngest sister, who was an adult with learning disabilities. My sister had always been cared for by my parents. They didn't, you know, she was probably unknown to social services or support services in the UK. And when mum died, that meant that dad was left caring for my sister. And I really wasn't quite sure how a 60-year-old man would cope in those situations. You know, how long would he cope for? Would he cope at all? And it was the first time I really had to think, what do I want to happen to my sister when eventually my father will die? And at that point, I decided that I didn't want my sister to go into care. I wanted to be able to care for her. So it was not anything that I was asked to do. It was something that I chose to do.
How long did it take you to come to that decision? Did you have to, you know, like, it seems like a huge sacrifice, especially when you say you were quite content in your career and your ambition was still to remain as a senior lecturer.
The decision, I came to the decision quite quickly. It was, you know, I guess I'd unconsciously been living with it for a very long time, but hadn't consciously articulated it. Once my mum died, I had to consciously articulate that and was very happy. It was very much a values-based decision for me. And then the question was, so how do I support my career? I did initially consider working part-time as an academic. And so for a couple of years, I transitioned down to 4 days a week as an academic, and then worked compressed hours. I had a head of department at the time who was very supportive and allowed me to do that, because that meant I could go home and travel the 300 miles home from where I lived to at least give some respite care to my dad and visit my sister. And that worked for a couple of years, and I thought I might be able to continue that until, of course, what I learned, big mistake, was most of these arrangements had been made through word of mouth with the head of department, who was very friendly and very supportive, but we'd not actually got human resources or contracts involved. And then the head of department changed, and the new head of department didn't want to allow me so much flexibility at all. He had the approach that I could work fewer hours, but they had to be spread out over 5 days, which really didn't give me what I wanted. And working shorter days didn't allow me to travel 300 miles to visit my sister. And so I realized then that I would need to seriously consider different career options. And it was only at that point that I really went back to the coaching skills and began to think, is this something that I could use in order to create an income and a career if I chose to leave academia?
Was there an in-depth conversation with that head of school, or, you know, was there a kind of a, could we sit down and talk about this, and this is my situation? You know, the way nowadays people seem, especially with COVID, there's a lot more kind of flexibility. There's a lot more of those conversations happening. People want to make things work for people. Did that happen back then, or?
Well, yes, we did have conversations, but I think that in general, the culture was much less flexible. And so I would explain my situation, and the head of department would say, yes, I understand, and I still need you to be here 5 days a week. And I was, so why do you need me to be here 5 days a week? Has someone complained that they can't access me? Has someone complained that I'm not available? I just need you to be here 5 days a week. I was very frustrated with that at the time, but it is, you're right, quite different today. I think there is a much more flexible culture within most universities now. And I hope I would have had a much more productive conversation if I was having that conversation today.
And do you think that you potentially could still be in academia if the flexibility was the same as it is now back then?
I honestly think that if I'd had a flexible head of department at that time, I would not have left academia. So you're right. And I would have found a way to make it work. As I didn't have that choice, I did leave academia. And it was probably the bravest decision that I've ever made. But I set myself up as a self-employed coach and trainer. And I decided I would be delivering training workshops on the skills that I wish someone had taught me when I was starting out as an academic. And so it might have been about time management. So how do you effectively manage your research, your teaching, and your other responsibilities? Because nobody had ever taught me how to do that. How do you really supervise your research students? Because nobody had ever taught me how to do that. I just sort of made it up as I went along. And offering courses like these, I discovered that I could make the same income that I'd had as a senior lecturer, only working half the time.
I'm curious about the skills that you've developed in academia and through being in it for that length of time, and how you've been able to harness those and take advantage of those for this other career that you've developed. Sometimes when I talk with academics, they're really surprised how valuable their skills are outside of academia, in the sense of public engagement, project management, those kinds of things. They kind of almost take those things for granted and don't think that employers, for example, will find them valuable. Were you surprised when you moved into a different area and you were like, God, I can, you know, this is something that I can really get my hands around and my teeth into, and I could make a real success of this because of the training that I've had up to now?
I think you're absolutely right there. Many academics undervalue and don't see how their skills can be transferred to other career options, I found that one of the biggest skills that I brought was, how does it work? I like understanding things. And when I can understand something and break it down, I then know how to explain it well to somebody else. And so that way of approaching things, you know, when I look at time management, when I look at project management, when I look at supervision, how does it work? Break it down into its component parts. Oh, yeah, so that's what I need to teach. That really helped me. Obviously, years of lecturing and beginning to think from the student's perspective, what is it the student needs to understand? What are the obstacles to the student understanding that? And therefore, how do I present my material in a way that will engage them and be accessible to them? That was invaluable when it came to training. Thinking of research grants and opportunities. Obviously, as a researcher, you have to keep coming up with new grants. You know, what do we not know yet? What might people want? What grant applications or grant funding might be available in the future? Anticipating things. And so that's what I do now with my workshops. You know, I have a core set of workshops, and then I keep thinking, so what else might people want? So one of the things I've created, especially during lockdown, is a workshop program called Resources for Resilience, because that's what people need now. And that is absolutely a skill set that I cultivated as a research academic.
What's your advice to academics? What do you say to them?
Mostly rest more. One of the things that academics rarely do properly at any stage in their career is truly rest. And not only is that good for them physically, but it's great for their creativity. Many academics are driven by external pressures and also by imposter syndrome feelings, the feeling of not being a good enough academic or a good enough researcher, to work longer and harder. And I think that one of the tools that I value most is that of reflection. And so I have a number of practices that I use now to reflect on what I am doing that gives me space to see the gaps for where I could expand. It gives me space to see the opportunities ahead of me, and it makes me much less stressed.
You've mentioned imposter syndrome there, and I know that you were going to talk a bit about that actually. Imposter syndrome has had a lot of publicity over the last number of years. But it was, you know, I suppose the research, it was looked at initially quite a long time ago. Some of the things people say, I've only succeeded through luck. I'm not here because of my talents or my qualifications. I'm here because something happened and I fell into this, or, you know, it can affect men and women. And sometimes people think it just affects women, and maybe that's because they talk about it a bit more. Who knows? People talk about perfectionists. They talk about being expert. What does imposter syndrome, how would you define it?
Imposter syndrome is not a medically diagnosable condition, but it's a collection of behaviors, attitudes, and beliefs that cluster. And so we can give it a name, imposter syndrome. Not everybody has all of them, and they appear slightly differently in some people. Imposter syndrome affects people on a spectrum of behaviors. So there are some people who know about it, know it affects them, but you know what, they've got it and they can manage it. Others are almost emotionally crippled by it and are really ill because of it. And of course, everything in between. But it's that odd situation where you know that what you have done is real because you've got the qualifications usually, and you still don't quite know how you got them. You still can't quite believe that you did it. And so there's this dissonance between logically knowing, yes, I am able and talented and I've done this, and emotionally, I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. I'm making it up as I'm going along, and I really hope nobody figures it out.
What led you to write a book on imposter syndrome, Margaret?
The short answer to that is that from a business perspective, it was a very good marketing tool. the longer answer to that is that once I had learned about imposter syndrome as a coach, and I'd never heard the term before I trained as a coach, I recognized that I'd been affected by imposter syndrome feelings for all of my academic career. I hadn't been able to give it a voice. I hadn't known what it was, but I could see that as a postdoc, I knew I was a good researcher. And yet I kept thinking, I don't know how I'm doing this. I'm making it up. Someone will one day figure out I don't know what I'm doing. How on earth did I get that grant? I was always second guessing myself. Once I became a coach and knew what it was, I knew how to manage those feelings. And so when I became a coach and a trainer, it was very apparent to me that working with people from this academic background, that imposter syndrome would be rife. And when people do research on imposter syndrome feelings, if they look at the general population, about 70% of people say that they are affected by imposter syndrome at some stage. If you look within communities where intelligence or expertise are valued, like a university, then the number of people who are affected by imposter syndrome feelings are in the 90s. So it is ubiquitous. It is a rare person who isn't affected by imposter syndrome in that environment.
In your experience, what happened? What changed behaviorally? Or if somebody was looking at you, when you realized, oh, this is actually what I've been dealing with, what was the change in you?
For me, it allowed me to go forwards with confidence, knowing that I didn't need to feel certain in order to take confident actions. And so I could live with this dissonance between how I felt and how I behaved. Just because I felt like a fraud didn't mean I was a fraud. Once I really believed that, just because I feel unsettled or uncertain doesn't mean I'm wrong, then I was far more comfortable actually putting into action the plans that I had, the ideas that I had.
It seems challenging to, on the one hand, acknowledge I feel like a fraud, or I have this feeling of this fraud feeling, and yet push through. How did you do that? How did you learn how to do that?
For me, part of the learning is in recognizing where imposter feelings come from. Now, I said it's not a medically diagnosable condition, but there are many things that many imposters have in common. And one is that they are different. So they might be people in a professional job or a professional role who come from a non-professional background. And I was absolutely that case, coming, you know, into academia from a family background that was very non-academic. And so we feel different. And in our heads, we change that message to mean, because I'm different, therefore I don't belong. Because I'm different, therefore I don't deserve to be here. Once I recognized that that was one of the roots of my imposter feelings, I could then say, well, you know, of course, I worked hard. I've passed all the exams. I've got the qualifications. I've got the experience. Even if I still feel different, it doesn't mean to say I can't do the work. And so for me, that allowed me to put the behaviors into action and just manage the feelings much more effectively.
It sounds easy when you say it like that, but it seems in action that that would be incredibly difficult to do and almost something that you would have to almost speak to yourself about in the moment of doing something. Okay, I know that this is what's happening. I'm just going to push through here. I'm just going to send this proposal. I'm just going to go for this promotion. Is that what's required? Is it that kind of dialogue within yourself to force you to do it?
Absolutely. Now, is that easy? For some people, it can be. But for many of us, we have had a lifetime of that very unhelpful self-talk. Changing that self-talk instantly is usually something that most people don't manage. It's not never, but often. And that's why working with a coach helps, because they can bring your awareness to your habits. And once you are aware of your habits, you can begin to change them. Now, in my workshops, I point out that this is an action of Hebb's law in action, the neuroplasticity of the brain. We can begin to develop new neural pathways as we develop new ways of thinking. And so once we are aware of our habitual thought patterns, we can then have a backup plan. When I see that I'm saying this, what I'm going to do instead is. And it doesn't take very long. With many of my clients, within weeks, they can see that they are changing the way that they habitually think and the way that they habitually respond to situations. Now, given that they've had a lifetime feeling like an imposter, to be able to get results like that within weeks, I think for them is usually quite a celebration.
That would seem very fulfilling for you too.
Mm.
Can I ask you if there's, this is like a random question, is there a correlation in your experience between those who kind of experience imposter syndrome more and a discipline or a particular pathway?
I'm not sure I've got a wide enough base of experience for that. But what I know is that the more different you feel, the more you will be experiencing imposter syndrome feelings. And so the more different you feel. So, for example, in engineering in the UK, only 6% of engineers are female. My imagination would tell me, therefore, that women working in engineering are very likely to be affected by imposter syndrome feelings. Because not only are they second-guessing themselves as an academic and a researcher, but they're second-guessing themselves because they are in an environment where they are often so different to their peers. And I guess in this discussion that we've had, I have focused more on the differences of, you know, maybe gender. But you can get those same differences from social class, from race, or from culture. And so, you know, any form of unconscious bias that makes people feel different would, I think, contribute to aggravating their imposter syndrome feelings.
Somebody told me that, it was you actually, that you were invited to talk on a radio show about your book, Imposter Syndrome. And you said, I couldn't possibly go and talk on a radio show about imposter syndrome, even though you'd written a book about it. Tell us about that, because it sounds, I suppose, kind of interesting.
Absolutely. And this is where I really don't ever say that I can cure people of imposter syndrome feelings, because I've not cured myself. I'd written the book called Beyond Imposter Syndrome, and it was doing very nicely on Amazon. And a colleague of mine who is a business coach and had a regular business podcast noticed this. She sent me a message on my phone saying, I see your book's doing really well. Congratulations. We'd love you to come and talk on the post on the podcast. It just needs to be a short 20-minute conversation, anything you like about imposter syndrome. When are you up for it? Now, I got that message and my heart sank. And it really took me 30 minutes before I was able to reply, yes, of course I will. Because I kept thinking, what can I say? 20 minutes, imposter syndrome. What do I know? And of course, I had that inner smile that I recognized the imposter syndrome feelings. And it still took me 20 minutes, a further 20 minutes before I sent the message back.
And when you were sending that message, were you sitting there going, just do it, just say yes?
Yeah. By that time, I knew that I could do it. Remember, we had the conversation a few minutes ago about once I've processed what's going on, I then know just because I felt like a fraud didn't mean I was a fraud. Of course I had the skills to do this. Of course I had the confidence and the competence to do it. But yes, there's sometimes this time delay in catching the thought and following through with a more helpful behavior.
We're coming to the end of the conversation, and is there one thing that you would want postdocs and academics or researchers to know? Or is there one thing you'd want to say to them from the experience that you've had of training people and being around them, in a sense, not being a researcher?
This is one of those questions that I should have anticipated you would ask. But of course I didn't.
That's okay if there isn't anything.
Really, the thing that I would see particularly relevant to the situation today, which is significantly different to when I was doing my own postdocs and becoming a lecturer, it is so much more competitive now that you have to know that this is absolutely what you want to do. Because there is a world out there beyond academia that is a rewarding and a satisfying world. You don't need to be an academic and a researcher to find your satisfaction and security. If you've decided to stay within academia, then absolutely negotiate your boundaries around your life very assertively, because it is possible to have a happy and a satisfying life and to really enjoy your research. But many postdocs, many academics are not skilled in negotiating those boundaries. And I'd love them to know that it is possible to have a happy life and a happy research career.
Wonderful. Margaret, thank you so much for speaking to us on Exploring Research Career Podcasts. It's been so interesting. And hopefully, maybe we'll have you back again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Linda. It was a pleasure.
We've come to the end of this episode of our podcast, Exploring Research Careers. If you like the podcast, maybe you want to tell your friends and colleagues or anyone who you think might get benefit from listening to the conversations. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @Eeyore_careers, where you can find new episodes as they're released. In the meantime, thanks for listening and take care.